Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Joel Achenbach. I cover science for the national desk of the Washington Post. And I'm very honored and thrilled today to have a chance to talk to Vanessa Weish, the director of NASA's Johnson Space Center, a place I've visited many times and really enjoyed. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, what a year for NASA with the Artemis mission. Congratulations on that seemed to go splendidly after a long delay trying to get the rocket off the pad. Tell us about that mission, if you can. What did we learn from Artemis 1? And describe it for our viewers. You know, what we learned, what exactly happened, and what's next?
Oh, absolutely. And the mission was wonderful. You know, as you said, you know, from a launch perspective, we did have to learn how to actually operate to fill the rocket. We did have some challenges, but once we were able to take off and the spacecraft was able to then separate and go into its lunar trajectory, we were able to learn about the Orion, which is a spacecraft that will carry our humans to the moon. And so just learning and making sure that the systems will have the ability to actually make the journey as well as return. And so for us, one of the large things for us to learn was how the heat shield would perform, making sure that we could actually re-enter into the Earth's atmosphere. The parachutes, I was watching that video and just reminding me of what it felt like when those parachutes deployed, to know that we were going to be able to actually prove that the spacecraft would be able to land and carry our astronauts back safely to the Earth. So for us, it was a test flight. As you said, it was uncrewed. And so it was ringing out the systems, making sure that the avionics systems, that we were able to actually withstand the environments that we had to go through in order to make that journey to the moon. We had the close approach. We can actually see how the cameras were able to look at the surface. We could understand our abilities to actually make those traverses and then to make the return journey home. So those, it was basically proving out and making sure that the spacecraft is ready for its next mission, as you said, which will carry our astronauts on their journey to the lunar orbit.
So I want to ask you about that next mission, Artemis 2. But first, I should note that the Washington Post, obviously, we cover space. We have a new series called The New Space Age that just came out this week. And so I encourage the viewers to check that out. Director Weish, tell me a little bit about, were there any surprises in how Orion worked or how the SLS rocket worked in this first mission? And then a quick follow-up is, when do we go again, or when do you send astronauts on a lunar orbit?
Yeah, well, I will tell you the big surprise was how flawlessly everything worked. You know, when it's a first flight, you're expecting that you're going to have some issues and you're ready to do a lot of troubleshooting of anomalies. And guess what? We didn't have a whole lot of those. The systems performed just like they were designed and demonstrated their capability. So I would say maybe that was a big surprise, because even now, I just cannot believe just how great the mission went. So because of that, like I said, though, we do have to get everything back. Now the spacecraft is back in Florida, and the avionics boxes, some of the subsystems that we'll need in order to go into the next spacecraft are actually being pulled out, and we'll need to make sure that there are no issues with them. We will continue to do some post-flight testing. We have what we call instrumentation, looking at the spacecraft all over it during its journey and its return, as well as I mentioned, that very important heat shield that protects the spacecraft when it comes back into the atmosphere. We have to study it, make sure that there are no issues or concerns. And so once we finish that activity and continue and finish outfitting of our Orion for Artemis II, then we'll be ready to put our humans on. And our expectation is that can be done within a 2-year cycle.
So are you saying that perhaps as soon as 2025 or 2026, or do you want to give us a year?
Oh, no, we're trying to get there by 2024. So, you know, we're basically, yes. So we're trying to get there by November, December of 2024. So a little bit less than a complete 2 years. As you know, as you mentioned, we ended up having to slip the launch a little bit, but we've gotten our spacecraft back. And so we think we have a real good shot at making the window.
Well, we have questions from our audience. I want to read a question. This is from Kweisi Rutledge from Massachusetts, who asks, what are the current technology gaps that you think need to be filled to enable longer duration crewed missions?
Yes, that's a very good question. So here at NASA's Johnson Space Center, you know, we do study the risk and think of what the mitigations are for doing long duration human missions. So some of the things that we study and are trying to mitigate are done right now using the International Space Station. So from a technology standpoint, how do we make sure that our crews have all of the proper water? How do they have the proper environments for when they're on these long duration journeys? One of the things that we do on the International Space Station is reclamation of water, right? So we're not able to carry all of the water that we're going to need to go on a very long journey. And so we'll need to be able to reclaim the water that the crews use during their activities. And so we have technology that we've been using to do that. Another thing that we look at is how the astronauts will be able to thrive in space. So how will their bodies be able to handle these long duration missions? So we study the effects of space radiation on the body. We also study the fact that there's not gravity. And so what do we do to make sure that with the loss of gravity, we know that there's bone loss, there's muscle mass loss. So what are the mitigations that we do for that? So these are the types of technology and medical risk gaps that we work on a daily basis. And we're doing that every day using the International Space Station and using our ground analogs.
Great. Well, I'm sure people have asked you this many times, which is the why question. You know, why is NASA doing this? Why does NASA want to put astronauts back on the moon? I mean, President Obama sort of famously said, you know, been there, done that. What is your explanation of why this is an important goal for NASA? Why is this worth the not only the money that goes into it, but just a lot of the institutional effort? And obviously, there's a lot of risk, too, for the people who will do it.
Right. So, you know, there's many reasons, but I would say from a scientific standpoint, you know, when you think about the lunar environment, what can you learn and what we have learned? So here at Johnson Space Center, we house the samples that we returned from Apollo. And so we're still learning from those samples today, but we went to one particular area of the moon. We have not gone to every area of the moon. So with Artemis, we're going to go to the polar regions. We have, through our reconnaissance missions, understand that there is potential for us to be able to use lunar ice or other volatiles that we could actually be able to learn how to make, whether it be propellant or use it to make oxygen, so that we could learn how to live on another body. Those are the things that we need to know in order to go further into the solar system. So to go to Mars or go even further than that. So that's why going to the moon, if you think about it, it's in our neighborhood. You can get there in 3 to 6 days and you can get home in about that time versus going on a journey far out to Mars, which is a several months to get there. So using the lunar environment as a learning environment, but also there are people that want to go there and they believe that there's exploration. So you think about early settlers here in the US that went and they found gold and they found other things. So people are looking at it from a mining standpoint. There are other people that are looking at it from a commercial standpoint. How can I go and maybe have a lunar hotel where other people may want to go? So there's many reasons for want to go. NASA, of course, you know, we're looking at it from a scientific discoveries, as well as us learning how to live and work in a on a body that's close to home that will allow us to then move on to Mars.
Do you think there'll be a permanent base on the moon the way there is in Antarctica?
You know, that's a really good question. Some of the things that we have looked at is we do want to have more of a permanent presence in the lunar vicinity. And so what we're building today here at the Johnson Space Center is a small habitat that will be in lunar orbit called Gateway. And that's going to allow us to have a place where we can go and we can then do lunar landings. We can have our human landing system go to the Gateway, go to the surface, come back, so that we have a sustainable presence. Eventually building a surface habitat and others that will allow us to be able to do excavations, come back to a home base, do studies. So we're planning to build up the durations of these missions. And eventually, maybe someone would want to have more of a lunar base and have that. We can learn there, but then also have a jumping off point to pivot on to Mars.
All right, I want to come back to that in a minute because it's fascinating to see the architecture of NASA's human spaceflight program and the different elements of it. But a quick question here from our audience. This is from Charles Sullivan from New Mexico, who wants to know what scientific reason exists for manned spaceflight to Mars, considering the recent spectacular successes in robotic exploration and the threats to the astronauts' health and safety on such a long and risky journey.
That's an excellent question. You know, we've been working really closely with our Science Mission Directorate. And one of the things that we do know is that human robotic operations working together will allow us to actually do further excavations, will allow us to be able to use the human to be able to assist robots and making decisions, finding and doing discoveries. If you think about if I send a robot out, you look at all of the rovers that we have sent to Mars, and they've been very successful. But the amount of places that they can journey to is somewhat limited. If we had a human that was also there together, they could actually map out a path and go out. The human has the ability to be able to do things that the robot can't do in terms of maneuvering things, to making a decision to pivot. When you know, going to Mars, a lot of people may not think about this, but there's a time delay between us and Mars. And so when you're doing that robotically, those are things that you're accounting for. Well, if you have the human there, they're able to automatically make decisions and to do things. So together, our scientists feel that that will be a very tremendous, very powerful way for us to be able to make those discoveries.
Do you think that we will, or NASA will, or some space agency out there, or some international collaboration, will put people on Mars in the next, 20, 30, 40 years? Is that, how doable is that? I mean, you just, it's a long way away, And you've shared your thoughts about how hard it is to keep people alive in space. You know, the bone density loss, the the challenges of space. It's in the radiation environment, the dangers with solar flares, the fact that people have to be able to be fed over a long period of time. How realistic is it? I mean, obviously there are people like Elon Musk, who that's the whole dream of SpaceX is to occupy Mars. How realistic is that in your opinion?
Oh, I think it's very realistic. You know, I do think that as Americans, as Earthlings, you know, we have a desire to want to go and we want to explore. So we understand what the challenges are. And so we, as I said, we've studied this. We continue to actually make progress on a daily basis on being able to come up with the technologies that we need. And so we're working on those systems right now. And I do believe that probably over the course of, as you said, you know, the next, you know, certainly 20 years that we'll be able to bring all of those to fruition. So currently, the program that NASA has is Moon to Mars. And so that is definitely what our goal is to get to Mars.
Has it been difficult for you and your colleagues at the Johnson Space Center or in NASA generally, or even among the contractors, that NASA has had these pivots in its overall strategy, which, after the Columbia shuttle disaster, there was a reassessment of what the program was doing. Decision was made to retire the shuttle, as you know. Decision was made to go back to the moon. Then there was a decision not to go back to the moon, but to focus on maybe a rendezvous with an asteroid. Then the decision was made to go back to the moon again. Has that been difficult and challenging in terms of putting together a coherent program?
Well, you know, yes. So anytime you change the mission, if you change the objectives, the priorities, some of that does require you to make design changes, right? Because there's different requirements going based on where you're going to be going. And so that has had an impact on our schedule for us being able to make the progress that we want to. We were fortunate that because with this last administration change, we've not had a change, and we're still put Moon to Mars as being what our strategy is. And so with that, it has allowed us to continue to make great progression as we've gone over the past 10 years or so, which is a very good thing. But you're absolutely right, and you definitely know your space history.
Well, I've written some stories about it, but I'm just curious. Was there some apprehension about what would happen to the strategic plan when there was a change in administrations after the 2020 election?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So we, wanted to be able to continue with the progress that we were making on Artemis. And so with this administration coming in and still supporting it, as you saw, we were able to go forward with Artemis 1, and we're making great progress for us being able to do Artemis 2. You're absolutely right.
So the other amazing change in space is the commercialization of space. So we have these private companies, notably SpaceX, which is a big partner for NASA. Tell us about that relationship. I should know this, but to what extent would the Artemis program rely on commercial contracts versus traditional contracts? And can you just speak a little bit about that relationship between NASA and SpaceX or other private contractors?
Yeah, so with the Artemis program, we're using both government-owned projects. So with the Orion, for example, and SLS, as well as commercial types of contracts. So we have included, as well as working with our international partners for their contributions. So for example, one of the things that we're looking at is in order for us to do the lunar landing missions, our first demonstration mission, SpaceX actually is going to be the provider for the human landing system. And so they intend to use right now today their Starship for that purpose. And so they are fundamentally a part of that overall plan. In addition, the spacesuits that our astronauts are going to be using. NASA has done a lot of technology development on suits for deep space exploration. And we made that data and all of the design, all of the testing that we've done on our spacesuits available to industry. And so we have two providers that have been selected to have the ability to actually build our suits under a commercial type contract. Right now, the first has been let to a company called Axiom, and they are going to be the commercial provider of our spacesuits for the human landing mission on the moon.
I want to ask one more thing about Elon Musk. You know, he's just bought Twitter. You know, he's constantly in the headlines. Some people would view his behavior as a little erratic. Does that create any concern at all for NASA, which is such a kind of a traditional agency, to have a partnership with someone who is a little volatile the way Mr. Musk is?
So all of our providers, whether it be SpaceX or Boeing or you know, Blue Origin, any of them, we have agreements with, and we have requirements that they satisfy in order for us to know that they are providing articles that are safe and that will allow us to have effective missions. And so that's the relationship that we have. And SpaceX has been really good. They have been providing our crewed launches from Florida on the Dragon going to the International Space Station. They have successfully met all of those requirements and have done multiple missions now for us. And so that's the relationship that we have. So it is very clear on our side, we have things that we have to do, they have things that they have to do, and we work together so that we're able to work our missions jointly.
Great, thank you. Let's pivot to the International Space Station. What is going on there? So Russia says, we're out of there in a couple of years, then what happens? And can you just address, I mean, it's been very interesting to see so many, you know, geopolitical conflicts going on the ground. In space, it seems to be a different realm, that there's partnerships that have worked very well, regardless of what's happening in Ukraine or, you know, Crimea or whatever. So I'm just wondering if you could address, what does it mean that Russia, it may be leaving the station in a couple of years?
So, you know, maybe just a little bit of a correction. So the International Space Station, as you mentioned, is a peaceful cooperation of many countries working together, and the Russians being one of them, and they have major components that they provide for the International Space Station. There was a little confusion, maybe lost in translation back in the fall, of statements that were made, but the Russians are committed to working with us on the use of the International Space Station. What we're doing with all of the different countries that are a part of International Space Station is making agreements as to how long each of them will be there. The U.S. government was approved by our Congress to be able to go for 2030. And so we're very excited about that, as well as some of the other countries. And so we're working right now with the Russians on what that date would be. But this earlier date that was discussed back in the fall, that was just a little bit of a confusion that happened. And so what we're doing right now is working with them on what they believe is the right date in terms of their technology and when they programmatically will be able to commit to.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And it'll keep us posted as to what's going to happen with the station. Actually, 2030, would there get an extension beyond 2030, or What is the scenario? I mean, I've heard it speculated that it would, at some point, would have to be deorbited, and I guess a controlled reentry into the Southern Pacific Ocean, but maybe the private sector would want to take it over. Can you address that, please?
Yeah. So if you look at the International Space Station, it has been a huge success, right? We have had our astronauts living on board the International Space Station for over 22 years. So that's a wonderful feat of engineering prowess, right? To be able to have a facility and it's still going strong. We make upgrades to it. We just recently did what we call a EVA, a spacewalk outside the ISS to make upgrades to the power system. So we do that to maintain the systems. And the Russians do that on their systems as well. They do same kinds of activities to make sure that we're keeping it up, kind of like you keep up your house, right? And so for the International Space Station, though, we have kind of anchored and said 2030 is the date that the United States wants to plan to discontinue use of the ISS. However, you know, technology, if it has the capability, then we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, we have been working on a strategy of having commercial providers provide space stations. And so there are companies that are building and planning to build their own space stations and have those available in 2027, 2028. We want to have an overlap between when these commercial space stations would come online to make sure that they really are ready, there's no issues, prior to us looking at deorbiting our International Space Station. And so we would use then those space stations for us to continue to do those studies that I was telling you about, learning on technology, et cetera, that we need to, from a NASA standpoint, for long duration flights. Well, commercial companies will have other purposes. They may want to have it be used for a hotel, or they may want to actually use it for other research that they could do for organizations outside of what NASA is looking at research for. The intent would be for NASA to be one of many customers that would be a part of those space stations.
So NASA has a tremendous reputation for its engineering and science. How is the United States, though, generally doing with STEM, including the pipeline of new talent, including a more diverse workforce? I mean, you know, NASA famously, when you go back to the Apollo era, it's all the same, you know, white guys in their ties sitting at the consoles and all that. I mean, has NASA done better at getting a more diverse workforce? What can it do to make sure that it has the talent it needs to be competitive in the global stage, where you have many countries now doing space travel and with big space ambitions?
Yeah, so you have many countries, as you mentioned, many companies. There's so many people that are interested and working currently in space. And as it is, it's like it is a renaissance, if you will, for space. But I think it's more for many technologies. And so we do need to continue to work on and increase the STEM pipeline.
That
means we need to increase the STEM pipeline. So that we have enough workforce to support our activities within NASA, within our aerospace community, with as well as other technology communities that are here. So what we have been doing is making sure that we work with all the way down to kindergarten or even pre-K with exposing children to STEM activities so that they can become aware of what it is to go into space or what would maybe interest them in science. We work with our universities. We work with community colleges because we have to have technicians in addition to your 4-year degrees. so that they can be a part of what we're doing through internships, through competitions, to get them to have hands-on experiences so that then they're excited once they get kind of hooked on this business, they want to stay there. But that's what we're doing today, is we're working directly with other different partners, whether it be Lego or I think Barbie recently came out with a line of astronauts. So things where people can see that they can be a part of this. And I know for myself personally here in this region, I have made agreements with many of the universities so that we can have exchanges with the students, exchanges with the professors, and make it such that they are aware of the needs, the requirements that we have, especially around workforce going forward.
Well, and that's with it. It is very exciting. Thank you so much, Director Weish, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you. And I'm looking forward to the whole series.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.